Yes, the champ is here. He's in the hearts of your Frank Relationships team. Yup, we're talking about the late, the great, the greatest, Muhammad Ali, on this edition of Frank Relationships.
You're listening to Frank Relationships with Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Yeah, as always, those are my babies. Thanks for getting daddy started today. Mwah. On Friday, June 3rd, one of my heroes died. But to call him my hero is an understatement. In fact, I'm in significant company throughout my region, the country, and the world. The man that won the heavyweight championship of the world three times, that gave us some of the most mind-blowing fights ever, and that gave up millions of dollars in his prime to take a stand against fighting those who he had no quarrel with, risking prison, bankruptcy, and his reputation, has died. But oh, is he remembered. And we're going to give him the best send-off that we can muster today. So to that end, we're going to get things started with one of my favorite authors. After Ali's death, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times titled "Muhammad Ali Shaped My Life." He's also the man that has given us characters such as Easy Rawlins, Fearless Jones, Socrates Fortlow, Leonid McGill, and the most dangerous man in Los Angeles, Raymond Alexander, otherwise known as Mouse. He's the author of Devil in a Blue Dress and recently Charcoal Joe in Easy Rawlins' Mystery. And when I heard that Ali had passed, upon compiling my list of the people I wanted to interview about Ali on the show, his name was at the top of the list, because I feel 100% confident in saying that this man loves his people. He is none other than Walter Mosley. Welcome to the show, Brother Mosley.
Well, thank you very much.
What did Ali mean to you in your early years?
Well, talking about Ali, I mean, I'm not sure I have a great deal to say about him. That doesn't mean I don't have something very deep to say about him. It's just that when you talk about him, there are many things to say, but you know, after a while, you know, there are a lot of like great people, you know, and you can give a whole bunch of lists. They did this, they did that, they did this, they did that, you know, but there's only one thing that I think is really, really important about Ali and his relationship in the world. Maybe it's two things. One is that he, through all of his fame, and all of his power and all of his influence, remained pretty much a regular kind of guy, like a worker. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that he was a boxer. In order to be a good boxer, you got to do the work. You can't get around it. You can't be, oh, I'm so famous, I could be a boxer. Or, you know, I'm so, like he used to say, I'm so pretty, I'm going to be a boxer. No, the truth is, you had to work, and you had to work really hard. And so I think that everyday people all over the world, you know, from China to Detroit, understood the kind of work that he had to do to be who he was. And I think that just that sharing that knowledge is an extraordinary thing. But he also stayed a normal, everyday guy. And so my amazement, which I think is most everyday people's amazement, creation with sunlights and insects and machines and gravity and rainbows, all that stuff, I think was a part of his life. And you felt that when you saw him, if you had the opportunity ever to talk to him, but even if you just listened to him, he was the kind of guy, he spoke in a way that appreciated creation. That's capital C, creation.
Yes.
And so I think that for me, that's the most important thing, that he was able to be at once our hero and one of us.
Indeed.
We have a lot of heroes who are not one of us. They're heroes. They're up there on a pedestal somewhere.
Yes.
But he was our hero, and he was one of us. And the second thing that I think is so important about Ali, and that I love so much, and that I said in the little piece that I wrote for the Times, I was talking to some other kid, I was in high school, early on in high school, and what do you think about Vietnam? What do you think about the draft? And I said, look, I am not going to Vietnam. Number one, because I don't want to get shot. Number two, that I have no desire to shoot any Vietnamese person.
Mm-hmm.
And I said it, and when I said it, I didn't know why I was saying it.
Right.
I didn't know where those words came from.
Where did
I just
get that
said it.
From?
And then sometime later, I realized, oh, I got it from Muhammad Ali.
Right.
Maybe not directly. Maybe I didn't read what he said or heard what he said, but he had such power and influence that the life I live to some degree was influenced by the life he was committed to.
That's powerful. One of the things you said was that about him being an everyday guy and a boxer, and you can't really be a good boxer and not be able to be around everyday people, because you have to work with other fighters. And the other fighters, all the other fighters that are going to keep your game top notch, they're not famous. So you got to be able to deal with other grunts in many ways, people who are
you
not
famous. You
have
to be ready.
And, something that is a strong correlation between Ali and your work is strong black men. One of the things that you do, if there's anything you do, your characters are rooted in strong black men. They could be on either side of the law, but you constantly have strong black men in your work. And I appreciate that to no end. And that's certainly, I'm sure, how most of the world sees Muhammad Ali, certainly how he saw himself, and it's definitely how I saw him. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I write about black male heroes, and there is no greater American black male hero in the world than Ali. Mm. Ali was a hero to people in Zaire, in Beijing, in Sweden, in Peru. I mean, there's nobody. Every Mexican who loves boxing loves Muhammad Ali because the truth is he was, in many ways, the everyman. But he was also a black male hero, and very clearly a black male hero, because his pride in his race outstripped his pride in his nationality.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is, a lot of people are like, Floyd Patterson or Joe Lewis will say, I'm proud to be an American. Well, that's really good. That's wonderful. And these are black male heroes, no question.
Mm-hmm.
But Ali is saying, I'm proud to be black. And he even talked about the Vietnamese. He said, my brown brother.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a notion of the heroics that he exhibited, and also because he was playful. It's not just being a hero, because a lot of times people be a hero and say, well, I'm an example, you should follow my example. Now, I didn't say that.
Right.
I would say, he said, well, you think everybody should do this? I said, I'm not saying what everybody else should do. This is what I should do. But at the same time, he would tell a poem, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, rumble, young man, rumble, or whatever he was doing. Mm-hmm. He was having a good time. He was out there for us, and he was having a good time, saying, you should be having a good time too. Because just because you have to work hard don't mean that you can't have a good time.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a beauty there, which becomes very broad. You don't want to get stuck in some kind of thing like, well, I'm an example for other people. No, I'm not an example for other people. I mean, I might be. They look at me and they say, wow, that's great. you know. But I'm living my life, you're living your. I make my decision, you make your decision, but I'm there with you. And it's a much bigger difference than being, you know, playing the great political leaders, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and Nelson Mandela, you know, Medgar Evers, definitely. But on, and all of them were great. But one of the wonderful things about Ali is he didn't have anybody. He didn't, I mean, he wasn't in the Nation of Islam, but still, it's his, the way he moved, he really didn't have people behind him. It was him. You know, he's the one who paid the price for all those blows to the head. He's the one who paid the price by saying, I'm not going to Vietnam. Yeah. He's the one who paid the price every time he ran a lap, every time he had a sparring match, you know. And what's so wonderful about working people, black people, certainly everybody, because to say I'm a hero, I'm a hero for everybody. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a beautiful moment where there were these white reporters, and they were like, you know, trying to interview Ali, but he was surrounded by all these, black bodyguards, and the bodyguards got kind of rough with the white reporters. And Ali, you could just see, it was on television, his hands just surrounded the guys. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, man, we're not doing that. These men are here trying to talk to me. Uh-huh. You know, they're not doing something bad. You know, and you got to go, well, he was being a hero for me watching, for the bodyguards who might have been making a mistake, and for the guys who were about to get their asses kicked.
Right.
All of that at once. And you know, that's who he was. That's who he is. You know? It's not like I feel like I own him, or you know, I did meet him once, you know, but the truth is that he belonged to all of us. And as far as I'm concerned, and this is like, you know, talking about somebody in your family, I don't think he ever made a mistake in his life.
That's powerful. Any thoughts on Malcolm X or Elijah Muhammad?
Well, you know, listen, I mean, both X and Muhammad watched their parents murdered in front of them by members of the Ku Klux Klan. Both X and Muhammad had gone through the ugliest, most vicious part of America. They in their own ways tried to articulate a moment that could relieve the pain. And I think both of them, that was their job. That's what was their commitment, to relieve the pain. You know, Malcolm X, one of the most brilliant men who ever lived in America. But when I'm talking about Ali, Ali's just a whole other thing, you know. You know, these people are writing, you know, really thick philosophy books. And, you know, and Ali, you know, belongs to a dance company. Yeah, it's like, you know, and you know, that seems like lighter and less important, but indeed, you know, we all dance. Very few of us read philosophy.
Yeah.
You know.
Was there any fight that comes to mind that you were emotionally invested in or that stands out?
You know, that was the thing about Ali. You know, it's like, I'm going to ask a question like this. Yeah, Ali said, "I am the greatest," which is a statement which I think is greatly misunderstood. Because somebody else said, "Oh no, Joe Louis was the greatest." "Oh no. Sure, oh no. Somebody like me, Archie Moore was the greatest." Mm-hmm. But that's not it. That's not it at all. Ali could win any fight. Mm. Even if the person he was fighting should have won that fight. Mm-hmm. But George Foreman, he should have won that fight. You know, Sonny Liston, well, I don't know about that. I don't think he could have beat Ali at that time. George Shivalo, Ernie Shavers. I mean, there were people there who had all the talents to beat Ali.
Uh-huh.
And he was the greatest because he did not allow that to happen. Hmm. It's not like he was the, you know.
He outthought him.
Yeah, no, it's like, you know, I mean, he Yeah. He did whatever.
He did what it took.
He had a psychological attack. He outfought them physically in the ring. He made them believe one thing when indeed something else was true. You know, and sometimes he just took his lumps.
So did
he said, "All right, hit me."
Did you think he would beat Foreman? Sitting at the beginning.
Nobody thought he would be Foreman. Listen, he was the only person in the world, and of course the people in Zaire. But outside of Zaire, he was the only person in the world who thought he could beat Foreman. You know.
Okay.
And Dundee didn't think he could beat Foreman.
Right.
he really could beat Foreman. You know. On the other hand, everybody thought he could beat Frazier.
Uh-huh.
And he did, but just barely, you know.
Right.
Another thing, and really I should probably go after this, but another thing that I haven't seen it written about too much, but another thing that I thought was really wonderful about Ali was he fought every fighter on their level. Mm. So you see him in a lot of fights, like those fights he had in Germany when he was waiting to see what the Supreme Court was, you know, whether he was going to get a trial, whether he was going to go to jail, what was going on. Mm-hmm. You know, he fought those guys. You know, those guys were in the split of round with Joe Frazier.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But Ali fought them for 15 rounds, 12 rounds, 15 rounds, whatever it was at that time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting. He brought to the fight what his opponent brought to the fight. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that dialogue, that physical language, which is really, really interesting. Because it's scientific in a way. He said, "Well, let me see what you do." Mm-hmm. What's that? Okay, when you do that, this is what I do. You know?
Right.
And it's kind of amazing. That's what, so one of the things that he always did was he always gave the audience a great fight to watch.
Mm-hmm. That he did.
I can't remember the number of times that he knocked somebody out in the first or second or third round.
Right, right. And he predicted the round sometimes, which added a level of drama to it and fun for the audience also.
And but also, I don't think he. I'm not completely convinced that he was trying to entertain. Mm. I really think that boxing. You know, my brother once said, if you cut open my head, you would see a boxing glove looking out at you from in there. Mm-hmm. You know, I really do think that he was experimenting with every fight that he had.
Interesting. Okay.
You know. Which is why they were all such different fights, and why they were almost all so interesting, no matter how bad the fighter was he was fighting.
Thanks for joining us today, Brother Mosley. Thank you for your novels. Thank you for your rich characters and characterizations that you give us. I hope I get a chance to have you on the show again in the near future to talk to you more about you and your work. Welcome to Frank Relationships. We are the show specifically tailored for my middle-aged brethren and those who love them. And we promise every listener, especially our brothers, that you'll walk away from each week's show with new information, new perspective, or a new disposition that'll help you be a better parent and partner. I'm Frank Love, and you can find me, my blog, and my various social media incarnations at franklove.com. You can also find me on ABC's Good Morning Washington most Friday mornings during the 9 o'clock hour. If you're listening to the show on Blog Talk Radio, please follow us, and then via iTunes, please subscribe so that you can effortlessly get each week's show each week. Also, if you're enjoying the show, and of course you are, please share it with your family and friends on your favorite social media platform. We're always looking for new social media friends, so help us help our communities by spreading the word about the show. Greetings to my co-host, Kwaku.
Hey, family. How y'all doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm good. Frank, you good?
I'm great.
Excellent.
Nancy Goldring.
Hi, Frank.
The consummate generalist. How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Good, good, good.
Great.
We're also joined by today's visiting co-host, Yao Denny Zulu. Greetings, Brother Yao.
Greetings, Frank. How are you?
Great, great. Who are you and what do you do when you aren't co-hosting?
I'm an international specialist in tort litigation.
Gotcha.
Sounds expensive.
For somebody.
It is for somebody. Who do you think you're going to get along with best today?
Oh,
you got
my
gosh. Me, Nancy, and Kwaku.
I'm taking bets.
Okay. Smart answer. Oh, my goodness.
As is the case this week with Brother Denny Zulu, there's a visiting guest host chair available each week here in the studio. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area or traveling to the D.C. area and want to join us in the studio on a given Thursday morning, email me at frank@franklove.com and let me know. We're talking about the late, the great, the greatest, Muhammad Ali on this edition of Frank Relationships. So, if you want to know how Ali saved one brother's butt in the South, how Ali's death marks the end of an era, and how much a 90-year-old man respected Ali, then stay tuned as your Frank Relationship team talks with a sampling of those that love and respected the greatest. I probably don't need to set the stage for our listeners, but if there's any value in capturing the tension in the air around some of Ali's fights, I'm going to let Brother Preston Riddick chime in. This brother's 75, he's 1 year senior to Ali, and here's what he had to say.
At that time when Muhammad Ali first came on the scene, we go all the way back with him when he was Cassius Clay in Louisville. So everybody was studying and making sure that this man was for real, you know, because that was the time he was doing that predicting. I would say Ali had the same effect on the African-American community as Joe Louis did. When he won the fight, we were always winning the fight. The time that he beat Liston, that was almost kind of unbelievable because Liston has such a serious reputation. He was known that if he hit you on your arm, he could knock you out. That put people in a kind of state of shock when he was able to do it. And you know, he did it quite easily by using those skills that he had. Mm-hmm. The second fight, we're still trying to identify that punch that knocked him out and everything. That fight had a lot of controversy to it because of that punch. Sonny Liston was tied in with the mob and everything. We weren't quite sure whether that punch was legitimate, mm-hmm. or if the fight was a thrown fight, but Liston was told to take a dive. I don't think Ali had anything to do with it.
That was Brother Preston Riddick weighing in. For the past 10 years, if you would have asked me, I would have noted that I would definitely be at Muhammad Ali's funeral, no matter when or where it was. However, his funeral has fallen on June 10th, the day of my daughter's high school graduation, and I cannot be there. When the day of the funeral was announced, my wife looked at me and said, "You're really affected by his passing." And I looked at her in bewilderment like she was speaking another language. I am really affected by his passing. And with that said, I wish to honor him. Yes, I do. But I didn't experience Ali firsthand like so many others, like my mother and father's generation. I'm a whippersnapper. Yep. At 43, so I, along the past week, made an effort to reach out to my elders to get their impression of the greatest. And the most eldest was Mr. Jackson Girth, who's 90 years old. Here is Mr. Girth's comment.
Muhammad Ali, to me, under the circumstances that he was born into this world, was the greatest man in his field. You want to take that ever lived in the world. Word. If all Americans, especially male America, were like Muhammad Ali, the English word could not express how great he is. I can't express how great Muhammad Ali.
That was Mr. Jackson Girth, 16 years, Ali Sr. And he had that level of respect for him. For as long as I can remember, Muhammad Ali has been part of my world. When I was a boy without a real understanding of his ring accomplishments, he was the greatest fighter that ever lived. And my father and every man that I knew loved and respected him. I watched his Saturday morning cartoon and remember my father taking him to one of his exhibition bouts. My pop also took me to see his movie, The Greatest. I seriously doubt I understood much of it, but as far as I knew, Ali was undefeated in the ring and could walk on water. His hands were literally lightning fast, and he was undefeatable.
They really were.
They really were.
They really were. It's funny, you're, what'd you say,
43?
43. So I'm 52. So when I was little, I remember bouncing on the edge of my grandparents' bed, like watching the fights. Mm. And the fight would come on. It was a huge event in the house. So, you know, dinner had to be cooked, eaten, and done mm-hmm. so that we could all be in full readiness for this experience. Yeah. And that's what it was. It was an experience. And I was little, and yet I was old enough to get the energy and the enthusiasm of the event. Mm-hmm. I felt very clear about who Muhammad Ali was, not just as a fighter, but like for people. Mm-hmm. I felt like I know my grandparents didn't know Ali personally, but it felt like they did. Mm-hmm. It really felt like they did.
He was, your grandparents were undoubtedly older than he was.
Sure, my grandmother's 88.
Wow, so he mattered
yes.
to them.
Oh, no question, no question.
You know, I say his hands were lightning fast, but if you really fast forward 15 years or so from the period where I was having those thoughts as a kid,
sure.
Sugar Ray's era had passed, and I found myself actually watching an Ali fight,
uh-huh.
you know, instead of just kind of relying on the myth. And the fight I watched, the first one I watched was against Ken Norton. And I thought there would be just sheer dominance. You know, nobody could possibly beat Ali. But Ali got his tail handed to him.
Exactly.
I mean, and it was, he lost that fight.
Yeah.
Now, the sequel came on. I was watching like ABC's Wild World of Sports or some repeats of old fights. It could have been cable. I don't know. But, the Ali, to me, at the time, he didn't really look impressive at all. And the sequel to that fight came on, the Ken Norton fight, too.
Right, right.
And I didn't think Ali was much more impressive in that fight. But the thing is, when you watch an Ali fight, you had to be clear about what you were looking at. Because it didn't even look like he was hitting these guys that hard. He was so fast. And he was just different. The
yeah.
way he hit, the way he held his arms, his speed was different than anybody else out there. So
especially for a heavyweight.
Especially for a heavyweight. Yeah. You had to really know what you were looking at.
Right.
And in fact, in the second fight against Norton, Howard Cosell said during the fight, anybody watching Muhammad Ali tonight must now be convinced that he's no longer a great fighter. That was...
That was a blow.
What year was that?
With his second one against Ken Norton. I'm not sure. I got it somewhere here in my notes. I don't know off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But Ali won that fight. And I started asking myself what all the fuss was about pertaining to Ali. You know, my first stop was with my father. So I told him, seemed like Ali wasn't as great as I thought that he would be.
Hmm.
And I mentioned the fights that I just watched, and my father explained that Ali fought most of that first fight with a broken jaw against mm-hmm. Ken Norton. And that it wasn't simply one fight that made Ali great, but a series of fights and the story associated with him. And that's what made Ali great.
No question.
And it's funny, as powerful Ali's stand was on the Vietnam invasion, there are two names that do not come up in most news stories. If you listen mm-hmm. to the news as they're discussing his death,
okay.
two names don't come up that were incredible forces behind his consciousness. They were Brother Malcolm X, also known as El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And we can't really have a complete conversation about Ali's political perspectives without discussing these two.
No way.
It's not possible.
No way.
You might call them Ali's father and grandfather, or older brother and father, but whatever you call them, they must be mentioned.
Oh.
If you don't, you're not really talking about Ali.
You're not really.
You're talking at all. You're giving your version of it.
Yes.
So here's what Sister Geraldine 7X had to say about Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam.
The education, the knowledge of self was the key, because people who were down and out on drugs, they were able to clean up just based on knowing who they were. And I'll tell you today, I have moved on from Islam, but that's my foundation.
Mm-hmm.
I consider the Honorable Elijah Muhammad as my parent. Now, I know everything wasn't 100%, but that was my foundation. It's mm-hmm. just like my grandmother. She mm-hmm. raised me with a fourth grade education, mm-hmm. but she gave me the knowledge to go seek more knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I look at the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I was just sitting having a cup of coffee, and my daughter had given me her book, How to Eat to Live. It was sitting on my table, and I was just saying, wow. I said, back then, we were taught to eat the brown stuff, the brown rice, the brown sugar. Mm-hmm. I said, and now, today, everything is full circle.
And we also have the pleasure of Ali's own words about the matter.
You are a wise man. You're an intelligent man. And if I was not a Muslim or follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I couldn't talk to you for 2 minutes. And I believe I can hold my own as an intelligent conversation with you. But it all comes from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But people praise me. Oh, you should be the leader. Well, you don't have to follow Elijah. Man, are you a fool? Everything I got come from him. He taught me who I was. He made me proud. He made me fearless. He made me love my own. I've turned down millions and to keep from selling out my people. The beautiful name Muhammad Ali. I now have 56 Muslim invitations by governments. All they ask me about when I go to those countries, how is Elijah Muhammad?
And we're also pleased to have with us a personal friend of Ali's. In fact, she notes that her late husband introduced Ali to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
To the nation.
To the nation, really.
In a large part.
Mm. Aunt Shirley.
Yes.
Hello, how are you?
Hello, how are you?
Thank you for joining us. How'd you know Ali?
Jeremiah, my late husband, was the minister. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad had placed him in that position over the southern region. And the temple in Miami was one of the temples that he set up, and that's where Muhammad Ali came into the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm. And what was his relationship with Ali like?
Jeremiah?
Yes.
Jeremiah traveled with Ali in 76. 76, 77, he moved to Chicago to be one of Ali's religious, religious
advisors, counselors.
Yes,
okay.
Thank you, counselor. And he also worked with Ali in some of the business aspects of there in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of what I said about you can't have a conversation about Ali without and his perspective?
Oh, I agree 100%. And it just amazes me how everyone has talked about Ali becoming a Muslim. And no one, I have not heard one person other than yourself mention the fact that it was Elijah Muhammad, Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who was instrumental in changing and making a pathway in this man's life, that he would be the person that he wind up being for the world.
Mm-hmm. And
it was Elijah Muhammad, and Muhammad always referred and deferred to Elijah Muhammad mm-hmm. as his religious and spiritual inspiration.
And that was for as long as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was alive,
no
wasn't
question.
It?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. No question.
And
absolutely.
What about his? What about Ali's relationship with Malcolm X? Would you talk about that a little bit?
Well, Malcolm came to Miami. Jeremiah, I think, contacted him and told him about Ali. And when he had that fight, that first big fight, I think it was with, who was it?
Sonny Liston.
I can't think of his name.
Sonny Liston.
Sonny Liston. Malcolm was there for that, I'm certain. Yeah, Malcolm was there for that. Jeremiah was there. Jeremiah introduced Ali to Herbert Muhammad, who became his manager for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But Malcolm was, he and Muhammad had a good relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And would you say he was a strong influence on him?
You know what? Elijah Muhammad was a strong influence on him. I must be truthful.
Okay. Right.
That's where the influence came mm-hmm. from Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
And what was your experience? Did you have any personal experience with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad? And
yes,
what did you
I
think
did.
What did you think about what he was able to do for black men throughout the country?
You know, there has not been another black leader, in my opinion, that has, well, you know, Elijah Muhammad was the first one that this thing, I'm black and I'm proud,
mm-hmm.
That was Elijah Muhammad. Mm-hmm. He was the first one who taught us to be proud of our heritage, proud of our color. You know, there was a time in my life when a black person would fight if you called them black.
Mm.
It was so despicable. We were made to believe that we were so inferior, so much of nothing, until we took on that same attitude with each other. So I can't say enough about it. It's just,
was he a fight
fan? It was a wonderful time in my life.
Was he what?
Was he a fight fan?
Was he a fight fan? Was Elijah Muhammad a fight fan?
Yes, yes,
okay.
Yes.
Malcolm X as well?
And he loved Ali.
Okay.
Loved Ali.
You got,
I was not a fight fan.
You were not
a fight fan. Oh, it's Shirley.
No, I was not a fight fan. And never have been, and not to today. But I was an Ali fan.
How about that? Isn't that interesting?
Gotcha.
Isn't that interesting? Now, how do you be an Ali fan and not
Ali had so much presence.
Okay.
Charisma.
When he walked into a room, I mean, he was the room. he took up his presence. I cannot even express to you how this man, what he gained coming into the Nation of Islam, it was the pride that Elijah Muhammad instilled in mm-hmm. black men.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that, and he taught us, the believers, just to be fearless.
Mm.
So, I mean, when we were in Mississippi, Alabama, wherever, there was never any fear of what was going to happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
I can't say enough about that. And mm-hmm. Ali took on that trait so strongly.
You know, I can relate to walking in a room and people feeling
so
much.
You know
so
what, Shirley? I just want to apologize. The show has taken a downturn, but I'm going to do what I can to bring it back.
Well, forget y'all.
Aunt Shirley, talk to me. Talk to us a little bit about how you can have a friend with all that presence, all that charisma, and all that energy, but yet he just feels like a friend. He was a regular guy to you.
Since Ali's death, have shown me pictures that I was in. Mm-hmm. I did not think I had ever taken a picture with Ali.
Wow.
He was my friend. I would go to Deer Lake with another friend of mine, Minnie Ali. I would go to Deer Lake. We would take the children. We would stay. We stayed for weeks sometime. It was that camp was so wonderful and so much of nature there. And he was always in the dining hall when you came in. Ali just loved people.
Yeah.
And I don't care if they're black, white, or mushroom. he loved people. And you got that feeling that somehow when I was around him, and maybe that I knew him so early on,
okay,
that, I mean, he slept in my home with his first wife, and her family were Muslims, and it sort of put a bond there.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, I don't know how, we had a humble place at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Ali came, he stayed, he ate, he talked, and he was a friend. We talked about the religion, or how we perceived that it would be years from now, and all of the things we talked about, and all that Elijah Muhammad ever told us that would happen with Islam. And at that time, to be a Muslim, you were just, it was like you were the worst person on earth.
There was a time when my understanding, this is pre-me, so there was a time when I understand that black people and Christianity went hand in hand. I mean, you didn't even question.
Absolutely. You didn't question what you were. If you saw a black face, you were a Christian.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the introduction of Islam was just something completely new.
It was just
new.
Something that I did not understand what. I know Elijah Muhammad told us that there would be a time that we would hear Muslim names in America, that we would be, the press would be full of Islam. I mean, he was a man, we say now that he was not the prophet, but someone had given this man some very good direction,
mm-hmm,
because he was only, I think, a fifth grade student.
Wow.
And there was no way he could have pulled this out of his mind with his humble beginnings. But it was a really wonderful, remarkable experience that I'm very thankful for.
What's interesting, what you're talking about, the Christianity and the fact that black people at that time was focusing, were not supporting other religions, is that he was able to rise above that. Muhammad Ali was able to make you love him even if you didn't like every of him.
That's right.
Mm.
If you watched any of his interviews, I mean, I watched an interview with him and Foreman on the Dick Cavett show. Ali was a true entertainer. He had you laughing, and poor Foreman.
Yeah.
I mean, to try to go tit for tat with this guy with words, it was a waste of time. I mean,
Foreman is a nice person.
Yeah, I mean Frazier. Actually, I mean Frazier, but Foreman is a nice person. But for Frazier to
trying to compete with Ali in intellect and words,
right? Leave that alone.
Stay in your lane.
Right.
What's also interesting, we're not even talking about boxing. If you compare him to the boxers today, we'd probably primarily be talking about the sport of boxing. But this just lets you know the magnitude of his personality and what he contributed to the world as opposed to just the sport. Because if we were talking about Mayweather, we'd probably be just talking about boxing as far as his talent.
Absolutely.
And so forth. We've rarely mentioned boxing in the last few minutes or so.
Right. That's right. Aunt Shirley, if there was any shortcoming that you would say Ali had,
I wouldn't discuss it.
Okay.
No,
I love it.
I love that. That's awesome.
Well, what about challenge?
Ali said to some of the believers, we were talking sort of intimate, and he was saying, you know, not to feel sorry for him, but they always said that. But in this setting, he said, you know, this illness is my ticket to the hereafter, because I now focus on the religion and only the religion. And I feel so much that this man, he had such insight in the world, I think, as he grew, and with himself, that he knew that you cannot be a spiritual person and a worldly person at the same time. So when the illness hit him, he submitted to it and looked at it as his ticket to the hereafter.
Well, thanks for joining us, Aunt Shirley, and bringing the additional depth to our understanding of Ali.
Yes, thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
We could probably talk to Aunt Shirley all day.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No question.
Up next, we have Brother Wazir. Brother Wazir was... Say that again, Nancy.
Wazir L.
Wazir L. He was security and worked with Ali for a period of time. Brother Wazir, you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm fine.
Thanks for joining
us
today.
Early in the morning. I'm here on the West Coast, so it's kind of early.
Okay. How did you know? How did you know Ali?
Well, I met Ali. I happened to go up there one weekend. I was visiting and up in
Where?
Camp at Deer Lake.
Okay.
In Deer Lake, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And just ran into Ali and we started to talk. I was with my sisters, Nisa and Amira at the time, and my mother, and we started to talk, and he was a Muslim, I was a Muslim, we were both in the Nation of Islam, and we just hit it off really well. And I asked him for a job.
And he, simple
and he
enough.
Said, sure, brother, I can find something for you. Mm-hmm. And that's how our relationship started. That was about 1973.
And so what was the culture like within the nation? What was the culture like within the nation and in the nation of the United States, being so close to Ali?
Well, you have to understand something. At being a Muslim at that time, being a Muslim was sort of like you were from outer space or something. You know, the community looked on you as looked at you as if you were alien, and especially following the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. When Ali converted to Islam, it brought a new light to Islam and to our Muslim community. Ali was a very charismatic brother, was full of light and full of energy. And he talked all the time about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he put Islam on a new level, on an international level through the teachings of Elijah Muhammad.
Yeah, absolutely, he did. Yeah.
Elijah Muhammad gave him his foundation. See, Ali was he had a great personality. He loved people. You know, he loved helping people. He was very humorous. He liked doing magic tricks. He liked entertaining people. He liked to talk. He liked that family environment. So when he accepted Islam, and he met, that time he met Minister Jeremiah Shabazz, and also was a brother in Atlanta, Brother Rahman, and those brothers. You know, they sort of gave him the balance that he needed in order to, tread in the area that he was going, because he was on an international level.
Yeah. The fights that he participated in, the fights that he fought in, Norton, Frazier. Well, Frazier was 74. Do you remember any of those? And do you remember? You got any stories for us? That being so close.
Well, Ali just amazed me. You know, you were talking earlier about his hand speed and his quickness. he was very sharp mentally too. And I used to watch him in the gym when he was training, and in some of his fights, it seemed like he had the ability to tell what punch that person, his opponent, was going to throw, and he would be moving out of the way of the punch and throwing a counter.
At the same
before
time.
Before the guy could even think.
Yeah.
You know, he was that quick. He was like a scientist. Mm. And he used his, his saying was float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what he did.
Ali was, one of his sparring partners was Larry Holmes. Did you know him or did you see him around at that time?
Yeah, I saw him around. And yeah, he had a lot of sparring partners. Yeah, Larry Holmes, I remember him. Very well.
What was Holmes like? And what were some of his other sparring partners like? Any stories there?
Well, Larry Holmes was a quiet guy. He was, at the time, he was very thin, but you could see he was always watching Ali. He always watched Ali, and he took if you look at the way he fought, his style, he got his style from Ali.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very intense student, and you could tell that he wanted to one day become champion himself.
Mm-hmm.
So Ali taught, he taught a lot of fighters. He was not just
somebody
who came in the ring and boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. You know, but the people he had around him, the fighters, his sparring partners, he would talk to him. He would always teach him, tell him about themselves, you know, try to snap him out of whatever mood they were in and make him aware of what they had to do. Ali was a great businessman, too. He was a great promoter.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. He surrounded himself with great people.
We've been talking.
Couldn't go wrong.
We've been talking with Brother Wazir of the Nation of Islam. At the time, he worked as security, and he knew Ali personally. Thanks for joining us, Brother Wazir.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Wazir.
Thank you.
We should have asked him what that was like, being security. That had to be the hardest job on the planet.
That's why you got a mic.
Or the easiest.
You know, you seem to be enthusiastic about the stories. I want to know about protecting this guy and yourself.
Okay. Well, what you got there?
I was really not. It was hard to be security for Ali. I was basically, I took care of his family. When he traveled, I would. His wife at the time, Khalila, and his daughter, May May, I would drive them around, make sure his family was secure.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
But to be security for Ali was, because Ali was all over the place. Yeah. He couldn't really secure him, and the people loved him.
got it.
Wow.
Thank you, brother.
Yes. You're welcome.
Take care. As has been mentioned several times now, the introduction of Islam into the conversation around African Americans here in America was really attributed to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And this is one of the points that Baba Ajay Okoto touches on in the following clip. The quality isn't as good as some of the other clips, but his points are. So they're well on point. And so please take a listen.
Meet in the cafeteria, we had all black people, all black children, black teachers. And we would sit quietly while we get very loud chanting in his efforts. But we would get very quiet at some of the questions that he wrote, that he raised. The Islamic peace was a question, but it was bigger from the church. We couldn't understand the depth. We didn't understand the entire history at that time. But again, it raised a question about the order that we had taken for granted as what was supposed to be normal. And that he proceeded through his career, in Miami, sometimes parading through Miami with his, little barricade that he had behind him all the time. Sort of raised the of African people's attention and simple self-identity. and raising questions about where were we, where are we, and what is this movement about?
That was Baba Ajay Okoto, co-founder and director of Watoto School. You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we're honoring the greatest, Muhammad Ali. We've got clips and personal accounts, and I hope that you're as humbled by each shared experience as I am. There's a brother that I communicated with on Facebook earlier this week. He shared a personal story that he had with Ali, one where he may have gotten himself killed if Ali hadn't interceded. Seriously.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Check out what brother Vernell Batts had to say.
In 1970, I was 16 years old. Went to Atlanta while walking around in the lobby one day. I happened to spot Muhammad Ali talking to a gentleman. I walked there. As I was walking, two gentlemen walked my way, and the two white gentlemen, one of them bumped into me, you know, and at that point, he stopped and looked at me and said, "Boy, you just bumped into me. You need to say excuse me." And I said, "I ain't saying nothing." And he said, "You're going to say excuse me." And I said, I'm not saying nothing. So at the point where I began to become a little heated and to tell him, I'm not going to say excuse me to you. You know, that's when Muhammad Ali happened to overhear the conversation, but I was just starting to get loud. And he came over and just said, hey, you know, what's the problem here? You know, and there was a white guy. Told him that I had bumped into him, that I needed to apologize. And Ali said, "Hold on, let me talk to the young man. Let me talk to him for a minute." Pulled me over to the side and said, you know, he kneeled over and put his hand on my shoulder and said, he said, "You down here in Cracker Land." He says, you can't win. He said, "The only way you can win is by making them think they win. They win." You see, and by making them think they win, you get the victory. But they left with their stupidity. Mm-hmm. And after he said that, he went over to the went back to the white guy and said, "Look," he said, "young fella didn't mean any harm." He says, "Why don't we just forget the whole thing, you know, and everything will be okay." And that's when the white guy said to him, he says, he thought about it, he said, "Okay, Mr. Muhammad." And he walked on away.
As his name suggests to most, Muhammad Ali was a Muslim, and Islam meant a great deal to him. It was his faith. And to discuss Islam and Ali's impact on the Muslim community, we're joined by Muslim thought leader and activist, Tariq Tare. You're not one of Ali's contemporaries, and yet you have some thoughts on Ali's impact in the Muslim community. What are your thoughts?
To just be unashamedly Muslim. I think in the age of the war on terror, mm-hmm. or ages, it's been a while since it started. Mm-hmm. I think also in the age of Islamophobia, which has become a full-blown-out thing now, Muhammad Ali stood for being unashamedly who you are, and he introduced African-Americans and really the world to a brand of Islam that was completely different than anybody, than anything that had been seen before. Mm-hmm. His Islam was directly related to liberation. It was directly related to a human rights struggle. It was directly related to social justice. And for the Muslim community right now, with all that it's facing, it's just something I can identify with because I'm an African-American. My parents and grandparents and, you know, much of my lineage has roots in the exodus of slavery. Mm-hmm. And also they were, you know, my father became Muslim in the 60s. And he started one of the first mosques, actually the first mosque in Maryland.
Was that under the Nation of Islam,
yeah.
or that was...
No, this is the first Sunni mosque in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
But he came through that same pipeline of Nation of Islam. So it's just very important that he even did the work that he did and spoke out the way that he spoke out, because it is that much more comfortable for somebody such as myself today.
With his funeral that's going on today... What effect do you think the reemergence of Ali in this big way and the manner in which he's having his funeral will have on the Islamic community of trying to bring or address the phobia against Islam?
I think one of the best ways to fight Islamophobia is to have people have as many earnest questions answered as possible. Mm-hmm. And even with yesterday, the procession that happened yesterday, you know, him having a traditional Islamic funeral is going to have a lot of people ask questions, and that's what you want to happen. And the more questions people ask, the more they'll know about just it is, what are these, you know, these almost 2 billion people on earth, what it is about their lifestyle and the way that they're practicing their religion. And what it'll do is, number one, even after 9/11, you started to see even more of the percentages of people become Muslim. They go up. And I imagine, this is, of course, so in theory, but what I imagine is you'll see more people become Muslim, and it'll be better for the Muslim community, because then we'll have people be, you know, really come and try to, you know, really make sincere inquiries about how we live our life. And that's something that doesn't happen in America when you're being otherized. You know, it's just like, mm-hmm. that's the way they are, and they're bad people, and we shouldn't deal with them.
Thanks, Brother Toure, for joining us today. Brother Toure is a thought leader and activist of the Muslim faith. Take care, brother.
All right, brother.
Thank you.
As I said, I'm 43, and I feel a loss over the passing of Muhammad Ali. And with that said, I know that there has to be an even greater sense of loss from my mother and father's generation. They were, after all, they were age mates. In fact, in talking to them, there's a feeling of an era ending. And so to speak to this, in part, I caught up with Baba Lumumba, and he weighed in on these powerful words.
Being a person who was only a year difference in his age meant that he was a part of my life that, you know, his life paralleled my life, in a sense, mm-hmm. that he was part of the same, born around the same time I was born, went through some of the things that I went through, and became this personification of resistance, personification of resistance to the system. And you know, the question for many black people is, can you resist the system and win? Mm-hmm. Can you resist the system and win? Can you be, in any way, can you declare victory,
right,
after you fight against your, you know, the system that oppresses you? Can you stand up? Can you have integrity? What do you gain? What do you lose? Mm-hmm. What Muhammad Ali represented is what you gain from that resistance, what you gain from that integrity, what you gain from standing up, mm-hmm. fighting the system at all costs, no matter what the temporary loss seems to be. You and your fight can be victorious, and ultimately we will be victorious. He sort of personified that notion to me, and his death also represents the ending of an era, sort of the era of the so-called 60s, which really started before the 60s. It started in the 50s, but that extended all the way up until what I call the period of Barack Obama, which is a total different set of energy. Mm-hmm. It's the Barack Obama era is collaborating with the system, becoming an ally and be a supporter of the system. Muhammad Ali represents being in opposition to the system, fighting it, just like he fought, you know, his opponents in the ring, and for the most part was victorious, and certainly was victorious in terms of his overall sports achievement. But he also fought the system that oppresses us, mm-hmm. the system that declares us to be inferior, the system that enslaved us, the system that we constantly have to fight against. And he was victorious in that struggle as well. Essentially, he didn't bow, the system bowed. I think that that was also an example of what was going on at the time. When he returned to the ring, which was like 71, you had, of course, the passing of Malcolm in 65. You had the Nation of Islam changing, and, you know, its focus. And, you had, you know, so what you found of him was sort of a mellowing. I don't know if it was a change, it was a mellowing. I don't think he ever recanted or said that his he didn't believe what he said he believed before.
He absolutely did not.
He mellowed by...
The only thing he did recount was his disavowance of Malcolm X.
Yes, he did. In which was, I think...
powerful.
He recognized was a big mistake. But... you know, that period of time and what's happening at that period of time is something that needs to be studied more. Now I know the narrative, the popular narrative is, at least the pop culture narrative is that both him and Malcolm changed and they weren't the fiery black nationalists and separatists that they were. But I don't believe that's true at all. I think that... I think their mellowing does not represent a change. It represents just saying it, not saying it as firmly or as above board as you used to, because you, as you get older, you're really not able to do that as effectively.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see it. And the thing that endeared him not only to black people, which is true of Malcolm X too, was that in your face. You know, white man is the devil, you separatist, nationalist talk. Without that, neither of them would have been the force that they were in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, you know, they took on all comers, him and Malcolm, and they took on all comers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like you don't see a debate in which Malcolm loses. You don't really see a fight in which Muhammad Ali doesn't emerge victoriously, even when he lost. He emerges victoriously in the sense that he comes back and he wins the next.
Yes.
So you have men who represented the not only the struggle but the victorious struggle and personal victory and integrity and those things are what endeared him to black folks, but it also endeared immensely to non-white folks and many white folks, as you can see now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I pick up the Washington Post on Sunday, for example, and say not only is his picture on the front page, but he has two massive pictures on him, probably 10 others in the page. I don't think there's been a king or a pope or a potentate of one kind or another who's received as much coverage in the popular press as he has. Mm-hmm. And what does that say? That means that they so deeply respect him. It doesn't mean that they agree with it. It doesn't mean that they're not still in opposition to what he stood for. But it means that they respect him so deeply. And it's that respect, I think, that the person needs for themselves and that we need for each other. You know, that the live a life that demands respect. And you will be victorious. And to me, that's what Muhammad Ali stood for, a man who demanded respect, who the whole world had to bow down and respect, who essentially went to his grave believing that his job was to serve black people and the interests of black people.
That's community leader Baba Lumumba of the Umoja House and the Council of Elders in Washington, D.C. You may remember a few weeks back when we were pleased to be joined by father, grandfather, husband, and publisher, Paul Coates. You can check out that show in our archives at franklove.com. But I also caught up with him after Ali's passing, and he had these powerful words to offer about him.
Ali's a symbol of resistance, a symbol of rebellion, someone who spoke back to white people white society, and spoke in the interest of black people. I mean, he did that before we were aware of his consciousness. But once aware of his consciousness, he just didn't take no shit. You know, he would not let people tell him what he was supposed to say or what he was supposed to do it, or the way he was supposed to say it or the way he was supposed to do it. That was a symbol of resistance that we sorely needed. He was a man at the top. I mean, you know, really, really at the apex, because when we saw heavyweight champions then were the most successful Negroes that there was. Mm-hmm. You know, like there were no chairmen of IBM, no heads of Xerox. You know, heavyweight champion, dude, that's like the highest you're going to go. You know what I mean?
Right.
That was it. That was higher than a principal. You know, in school, heavyweight champion, my man. He cares about his God, and he cares about a God of black people that was going to be in service of life. And he had no problem telling white people that. Yeah, the man was bad. The man was bad. And he was an inspiring, an example of how we could be bad and how we could be resistful. Yeah, very, very much so. So he was very emblematic of the generation for me.
That was Paul Coates. You're listening to Frank Relationships, where we promise every listener, especially our brothers, that you'll walk away from each week's show with new information, a new perspective, or a new disposition that'll help you be a better parent and partner. You can find this and past shows, they're over 100, and my blog at franklove.com. You can also purchase the first edition of my book, How to Gracefully Exit a Relationship, in ebook there. The hard copy of the first edition sold out, and the publisher's working on bringing you the second edition soon. Again, that's franklove.com. I mentioned earlier how my father told me that there was more to Ali than his accomplishments in the ring. But, you know, at that time, it didn't make much sense to me. But I had a desire to kind of learn more about the myth. And that myth, I must say, it lingered. It was with me, which is probably a tribute to the widely accepted greatness amongst my seniors, my dad, my mom, my uncles, aunts, and you know, all of these, my grandfather and grandmother. And I began to watch his old fights, and I'm talking about his real old fights, like, I guess, Sonny Liston and Zora Foley and Floyd Patterson. These were the fights that he was in prior to being stripped of his title, which, you know, it reminds me of a conversation that I had with the great boxer and trainer Adrian Davis years ago. And he said the most important punch combination was the 1-2. And that's the jab and the power hand.
Okay.
And he said, look at Ali. That's all he threw. And if you really think about it, that was Ali's bread and butter. 1-2, 1-2. Just all day.
He mastered the basics.
He mastered the basics. And it was that over and over again. And he beat everyone in his prime. It was impossible to beat him. And all he repeatedly threw was the 1-2.
Wow. Yeah, I think, as a matter of fact, Ali had a camp for children. Mm. And he taught much of what he knew.
Mm.
And one of our former guests actually went to that camp.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Ah. And
he sure did.
Who's that guest?
Akeem Scott.
Akeem.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
So you knew Ali?
I did.
Ah.
My family did. And, you know, he was intimate part of, I mean, a lot of your guests talked about just how the effect that Ali had on your life. He continues to have an effect on my life. I mean, much of what I do kind of relates to my early background as a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And the training that we received as Muslims. They call this the junior FOI, or the fruit of Islam.
Mm.
We got training in the martial arts and boxing and and, you know, formal training and how to be a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And those early camps we talked about, they talked about Deer Lake, those early experiences in the summer of going up to the camp and training, doing some of the children's training, and just being up there and the beauty of it, it had a major effect on me as a child, and it continues to have an effect on me as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much everything I do, from family, my occupation, how I see recreation, and even on how I make money. So he had a profound effect on my life.
Give me one of those Ali stories, something you saw as a child that you can't forget.
Okay, so I'm in my teens, I say about, you know, middle 70s, and at the training camp, the thing that was most impressive is just how Ali would take the time to come over to us as young kids and just spend individual. You felt like you knew him as a coach personally. Mm-hmm. He took the time. He knew your name. He interacted with you individually,
mm-hmm.
and he zoned into you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me was most memorable. And like I say, it's some of the lessons that that embody what I try to do when I'm with you, my own child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just impactful. A lot of what I saw from him is just more how his behavior. Mm-hmm. That was the most impressive. So it wasn't. I could say there's a lot of little incidents, but it's mostly for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly on his character, mm-hmm. and how he treated each person that was in front of him, even the people that didn't like him. You know, I can remember hecklers. You know, I can remember, you know, white folks would come and, you know, they try to play the whole, you know, superiority game in little increments, and then they couldn't get away with it. You know, in big doses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's little increments of, you know, I'm really the boss here.
Mm-hmm.
And Ali would never confront these issues with animosity. Mm-hmm. It would always be with humor, misdirection, redirection. You know, just pattern interruptus. This is a term that I like to use, because that's what the way I saw it. He would interrupt, you know, what you had going on to really redirect it into a much more, you know, I'd say pleasant, more believable. And he would teach lessons in that way.
Yeah.
You know? So you could never really nail him down to the whole racist thing. He would redirect you. And if he was going to teach you a message, you couldn't have your program running, because his was much more funny, much more believable. And through the humor is how you would see it. I mean, then honestly, you go home thinking about it. You're like, damn.
Right.
You know? it would be a message that would stick with you.
Resonate, absolutely.
That's
nice.
We've been talking with Brother Akeem Scott. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, Frank, I just wanted to... You talked about our parents' generation,
mm-hmm.
and how they saw Muhammad Ali, but I'm 43 as well. And if you recall, when we were coming up, he was already that superstar.
Absolutely.
And that superstar who we were seeing in the cartoons, that was beating up Superman in the comic books, that gave us a sense of pride.
Absolutely.
That was passed on through this superstardom.
Right.
And it was embellished upon by our parents. And so it gave us, I believe, a leg up in feeling good about ourselves,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to believe in that myth that you talked about. And we made it true for ourselves as well.
Right, right. I like to say, well, you heard me at the beginning say he was one of my heroes, but I really think he was a superhero. You know, Ali was
superhero.
Yeah,
I
mean, and Nancy, there's something worth really bringing you into the conversation in another level as a woman,
mm.
because I mentioned my wife she couldn't relate. When I was visibly bothered by not being able to attend his funeral, my wife was like, "Is like, she didn't understand. I mean, she cared,
yeah,
and it mattered,
yeah,
but she didn't understand the depth of caring that I had. And even I remember going to see When We Were Kings.
Oh, wow.
With
yes.
My first wife when we were dating, and she thought it was a guy thing. The level of what Ali meant. Mm. I mean, it was, so I think the women in our generation don't necessarily feel the same way as we do as men about Ali. I could be wrong.
I hope you are, because I remember going to see When We Were Kings, and I was just...
You're a little older than me.
Yeah, and I wonder if for your wife, if it was, you know, some people feel, well, you didn't know them, like mm-hmm. you didn't have a physical face-to-face relationship with the person. And oftentimes it's a celebrity, how much could they have really
mattered to you, right?
Mattered to you. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I am a little older, and I certainly never met Ali, and yet watching.
I met him.
Did you really?
I did. I met him.
He came over to Howard. You see how he saved that to the end, y'all?
It was about 15 years ago when I was working at Howard. Yeah, yeah, I met him.
You were grown?
Yeah, I was grown.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I even got a glove. I got a glove that he signed.
Come on.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
It's in an undisclosed location.
I bet it is.
Safe deposit box.
But I'm going to find out. Peel back the layers on that story. Wow. So then you do have a personal story. You made a connection. How'd you get a glove out of Ali?
Well, they're two different.
eBay?
No. I sent it to him. Well, first off, I was working with a nonprofit at the time. So I bought a pair, and then the nonprofit bought a pair of gloves to send him to be signed for this auction that we were doing, sports memorabilia auction.
Sure.
Send it to him. He signed it. Sent it back.
Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So I got mine.
Very good.
Yes.
He got it. Yeah, I got mine, he says.
How come you didn't do one for me, bro?
Yeah, well, you know.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Bro.
I got one from Joe Frazier. Okay. I got one from Max Schmeling.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't even know Max Schmeling.
Max Schmeling was basically the, in some ways you could say, trumped up nemesis of Joe Louis.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh.
The German-American thing.
Okay.
And I understand. I say trumped up because I understand that they became friends.
Okay.
And stayed in touch, you know, for the rest of their lives.
Right.
And Max Schmeling was, mind you, he only died recently, within the last 10 years or something
sure,
like that.
Sure, sure,
so
sure.
He signed a glove also.
They pitted him back, from a racial standpoint against Joe Louis.
Oh, yeah. I got it. Mm-hmm. I got it. Because that's what sold tickets.
Right.
No doubt.
I mean, but that was it. There was a Hitler thing there, all of that. Yeah, it was a lot going on.
I'm older than all of you, so I grew up knowing Cassius Clay, mm-hmm. Muhammad Ali, was the most famous man in the world. Mm-hmm. Forget about Gandhi.
Yeah.
Forget about any other sports hero of the time, including Joe Louis, Wilt Chamberlain, O.J. Simpson. Ali was it.
Jim Brown.
Mm-hmm. Ali. Everybody knew the name.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And everybody has their own personal stories. I won't bore you with mine. Because he trained up where I grew up for a couple of the fights. But that's neither here nor there. That's my story.
Okay.
More impactful than anything else, there is an entire generation of folks in the world now that say, we are hip-hop. Guess who started rhyming to communicate effectively?
Yeah. No question.
I'm sorry, Afrika Bambaataa, Furious Five, Treacherous Three. Ali is the king and father of hip-hop communicating in rhyme, and he flowed
no question,
like no other.
And made you laugh.
Oh, my God.
Unscripted.
Right, and what's interesting about that is Muhammad Ali actually released albums where he was talking about his, before he even fought Liston, he put out an album talking about when he was going to knock Liston out.
An album?
An album rhyming. I was listening to it on NPR a couple of days ago. I mean, this guy was transformative as far as how he made himself a superstar and made you believe and love him.
He was bad long before LL Cool J.
Yeah.
But the other thing is,
Mama said knock you out.
The impact, the impact of media.
Yes.
Okay, now it's saturated and anybody can blog. And back in the 70s, there was this dynamic between Ali and Howard Cosell. That was so deep and so meaningful and entertaining and important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because here's Cosell, this aging Jewish lawyer, you know, antagonist and respected sportscaster.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No question.
None.
And they had this relationship that was magic. And then it transformed. I mean, I remember Ali's first interview that Marv Albert did with him.
Mm-hmm.
And Ali had never talked to him before. And Albert was already on his way up and for all intents and purposes taking Cosell's place as that sports guy.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Ali's like, I never met you, but I heard about you. You're not as dumb as you look. Who does that? He was the greatest.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Cosell and Ali were a theater to themselves. Right. They really were.
One of my favorite things is when Howard Cosell said to him, I think you're being truculent. Well, whatever truculent it is, if that's good, I'm in.
Wow.
You know, I got a Jim Brown story for you.
What?
And that Jim Brown story is brought to you by Donald 9X.
Hmm.
Here's what he had to say.
Jim Brown, who was in the Foreman camp, drove up in a Lincoln limo. And he being the movie star, you know, popular ball player that he was, he pulled up in a crowd quickly, you know, came around him, you know. He was Jim Brown, you know, he was admirable in our community also.
Right.
And I don't remember whether he did autographs, but he shook a lot of hands and, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. And then the question of who was going to win the Foreman Ali fight came up. And he came out of his mouth with Ali can't be Foreman. He literally had to run and get back in the limo and get out of there because he was going to be mobbed.
Again, that was Brother 9X. In fact, Donald 9X. In fact, he was in the Nation of Islam with Ali at the time. There was also, I mean, Jeff has weighed in. Jeff's a white guy. But there was also a relationship. Go. What you got to say, Jeff?
Thank you for noticing.
Jeff isn't the only white guy that cared about Ali.
Not by a long shot. Yeah.
Before you make your point, and please don't forget it, you know, you asked somebody earlier, was there any negative or any challenges with Ali?
Mm-hmm.
I found fault, as did many African Americans, with the way in which Ali made fun of Joe Frazier.
Yeah.
Because of his skin tone.
Yeah.
Mm. And that was very odd. I mean, he's calling him.
Maybe not because of.
But in addition to.
But he did it. Right. He definitely did it. I mean, and he may have done it because he was promoting the fight.
Oh, absolutely.
And that was just something to pick on him with.
But normally he would antagonize due to talent or lack thereof. Mm-hmm. I'm going to beat you because of this, this, and this. Calling him gorilla and all the other stuff.
Right.
Because he was darker and then you had the whole light skin darkening. That to me was one of the more negative things, or you know, a chink in the armor, whatever you want to call it, because people do put Ali on a pedestal, and certainly in death, and he will live on. The legend is there.
Sure.
That's a lesson, though, that I think he did wind up apologizing
for. He absolutely did.
And remedied it. Yes. But it is part of his story.
Yeah.
That should be mentioned.
Yeah. And it was cruel.
Hmm.
It was cruel. And the thing is, there were two fights. There were two fights, and to say there are two fights, there were three real fights, but there were two fights for each fight.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the pre-fight build up, the war, the words,
yes,
and the actual ring fight. And Ali won. I mean, like we were saying, the war, the words was never a war. I mean, it was no, right. Frazier had nothing for him in that capacity. And in many ways, it was cruel, particularly with the Thriller in Manila. I believe that's when he did the gorilla thing.
Right.
Up until that point, I think the second fight, he called him ignorant. And even that was cruel. There was some, they were definitely
below the belt.
Yeah, yeah. And now, if you just take that as pre-fight promotion, that's fine. But Joe Frazier was bothered by this. He was sincerely bothered by this.
And was his family.
And was his family. For, like you were about, I think you were about to say, for a long time. I mean, Frazier was bitter about this. And that's not something to take lightly.
Yeah,
I mean,
you can't blame him.
Yeah, you can't blame him, particularly because it was the case. I mean, it's one thing if you look at Foreman. Foreman was, he went at Foreman in the same way, the big bear, and a bear isn't as insulting as a gorilla in the way we look at it. But he insulted Foreman, he taunted Foreman. But Foreman, he had his moments where he was down and, you know, he was in the dumps after his loss to Ali. But Foreman came back a lot earlier and with a better perspective than Frazier. Frazier was bothered for.
The reason why it's so important and impactful is Ali was so important and impactful to black people and what they meant to society, not just America, worldwide society. And by doing that, it gave those who found fault with African-Americans who could escalate themselves on a large scope, it gave those who found fault with that another reason to go, see, there's even division within the race because of that couple of comments.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, yeah. Here's a quick clip on what Coach Bernie Bickerstaff had to say about Ali. He's a former coach of the Washington Wizards.
I haven't met many people who would kind of just stand up for what they profess as their beliefs. They will do. Ali, being who he was always front and center. No hidden agendas.
That's Coach Bernie Bickerstaff. And I was going to, I was mentioning a few minutes ago that Jeff isn't the only white guy that respected Ali. And I had a chance to talk to a friend, Greg Henson, earlier in the week. And here's what he had to say about his dad and how he grew to appreciate Ali.
Because my dad hated him when he first came out of the scene. Just thought he was a loudmouth jerk. So by the time Ali had retired, he was one of my dad's favorite athletes of all time.
Really?
Because when he came on, he was just a big mouth. You know, and that wasn't the norm back then. You know, now every athlete, you know, puffing out their chest every chance they get.
Right.
But, you know, and my dad had a real problem with the Vietnam thing just because my brothers were there.
Wow.
Yeah, but he came around. I remember when he lived, of course, at the Olympics in 96. My dad was really moved by it.
We've been paying our respects to the greatest, Muhammad Ali. Thank you to my guests, those that joined us today, and those that provided pre-recorded statements. Thank you to attorney Yao Denizulu. He's a personal injury attorney in Chicago. Thank you to my co-hosts, Kwaku and Nancy. Thank you to Jeff Newman, my engineer, who I've worried the heck out of over the past few days as I've worked to try to make this show as meaningful as possible. And thank you for hanging out with the Frank Relationships team today. You've been great. I hope you've had as much fun as I've had sharing and hearing stories about one of my heroes, Muhammad Ali. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Facebook.com/RelationshipFLove, on Twitter at Mr. That's MR Frank Love, or at franklove.com. If you're listening to the show via Blog Talk Radio, make sure you like us there, and if via iTunes, make sure you subscribe so that you can receive each week's show each week. This is Frank Love.